One of them just looks at the camera at one point and goes, "The proposal." And
yes.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
We're the good guys.
What are you talking about? There aren't any good guys. You realize that, don't you? I mean, you realize there aren't evil guys and innocent guys. It's just a bunch of guys.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 126 of Wreckatopia. Aaron is holding up things that I don't even know what they are. This is episode 126 of Wreckatopia. Today's big recommend is Zero Effect. I think this is the first time I've introduced something as a big recommend at up top in a while, because the last six episodes we were doing movies we didn't like, and I didn't want to call them big recommends, even though I think we ended up calling them big recommends on the show. And I think we were like two out of six on those movies, turning various people around or whatever. Mm-hmm. But anyway, my name is Chris Atkinson, and I'm joined by Aaron Dicer.
Howdy ho, Effectorinos.
Mm-hmm, that's right. We'd like to once again welcome chat to the proceedings, and I will go ahead and start us off with our small recommends.
Do it.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Went to our local Bell Court here in Nashville, not for Aaron, but for me. They had the 4K restoration of Amadeus playing at the theater. This movie won Best Picture in 1984. It won 8 Oscars. And I remember the first time I ever watched this movie, when I was about to watch this movie, I had a real bias against costume period epics.
Mm.
And I was not looking forward to it. And movies in the 80s that won Best Picture didn't necessarily mean they were good, especially for my generation. But then I watched it, I think somewhere in the 90s, and it's like, man, this movie isn't stuffy at all. It's like got comedy in it, and it's really well done. And seeing it on the big screen for the first time ever was a great, great experience. For those of you not in the know, this is basically a movie about the rivalry, quote unquote, between Salieri and Mozart. And Salieri is an old man telling a priest a story about what he knew of Mozart from the point that he was a child all the way up until his death, and how much he appreciated and loved Mozart, but he was also frustrated by him because he felt like he had the gift of music too, but God had given Mozart way more ability and skill and everything, so he was also jealous of him. And he tells the priest right off the bat, "I killed Mozart." So this whole story is about, "I did this, and here's how this story came to be." And man, I tell you what, this movie's so good. F. Murray Abraham is just awesome in this movie. Tom Hulce as Mozart, amazing as well. The thing about this movie that I kept noticing all the way through is how well edited it is. I thought it won Oscar for editing. This is how good it was. It won 8 Oscars, did not win for editing that year. I think it was The Killing Fields that won. But I was so appreciative of this editing, because I have seen so many movies lately, movies that I've been sending, that have terrible editing. And it's a breath of fresh air when you see something that is well edited, something that doesn't waste time whatsoever. It goes right into things, just boom, boom, boom. There's not one wasted motion in this movie. So yes, this is a small recommend, but it's very easily a big recommend if you have never seen this.
Yeah, I throw my entire gumption behind that recommend. I only saw this for the first time within the last 3 or 4 years. I can't remember exactly, but it's been recently enough. And it blew me away. I was like, why did I wait so long to watch this movie? And I think it was, maybe I had in the back of my head that it was kind of stuffy or just kind of a cost, you know, a period piece kind of thing, like you were saying. And it's so much more than that. It's not only fun and entertaining, it also is really interesting and meaningful. Like, I came away from it like having these deep thoughts about what is excellence and the difference between those who feel like they were born for something and those who work their whole lives to become excellent at something. And yeah, the nature versus nurture, you know, kind of aspect of that. So it's just really interesting, and it's just a great movie. I love
it. Yeah, it sure is.
I'm going to the TV world this week, and with a couple of shows that have wrapped up or mostly wrapped up. I'll start with the one that's mostly wrapped up. I think there's one episode left of House of the Dragon, season two. I am really loving this show, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's not a lot on television like this right now, like a serialized, well-thought-out sci-fi fantasy. I mean, fantasy is the higher of those genres, probably, in this piece with dragons and those kind of things. But this show is so good. The performances are so good. And beyond that, the stories are intricate enough that they are worth thinking about and processing and wondering, like, how is this relationship going to resolve? How is this thing going to resolve? And yet it doesn't have that first couple seasons of Game of Thrones thing where it was like, I don't know who anybody is. Like, there's, it seems to have found a really nice balance of focusing on the people that we need to know, giving enough of the periphery world for us to find really interesting pieces to pick out. And then just, as I mentioned, the performances, Emma D'Arcy, Olivia Cooke, Matt Smith, all just absolutely incredible in this. So it's getting really interesting, and the dragon stuff is starting to pop off, and that's like really fun too. So, yeah, I'm super excited for the finale and have been having a really good time with season two of House of the Dragon. It also is, I think it's better than season one just because season one, just ran through time to get us to this point, right? Like, it just felt like we were trying so hard to get through so many things that were important, but we just kept jumping in time, and now we're locked in. It feels like we're locked into a timeline and not doing a whole bunch of jumping and stuff. So it's been a really good season, I think.
I haven't seen any of season two. I saw season one, and that what you're talking about there sort of made me not excited about season two coming back. And how long has it been? It's been 3 years, maybe, since
it's been a while. Yeah.
But I mean, I've heard enough good about season two that I may end up watching it, but I may just wait for the series to wrap and watch it, watch the rest of it once the series is wrapped. I just don't know. This is it's one of those things, like Game of Thrones, like, was quality forever, and then the final season happened, and it was like,
guess for me, the only pushback I would give on that, for me, so much of the fun is listening to a podcast between episodes, you know, hearing what other people are saying. Like, I really like the idea of weekly serialized television where you can think and ponder and have discussions and talk to people who have read the books and go, hey, think deeper about this part. Like, I really loved that part of Game of Thrones, and a lot of that is here as well. I have a couple podcasts that I listen to in conjunction where each week I'll go, oh, I didn't think about that. Oh, I didn't know that the book is different in this way, or, you know, whatever. So part of the entertainment and joy for me is actually the weekly discovery. And I think with, you know, binging afterwards for me would be a little less fun because I wouldn't have that part of it. But yeah, everybody's different in a, you know, for some people, a binge may be the best way to enjoy it. So,
All right. My next one is something everybody has seen. It's Deadpool and Wolverine. The movie made like $450 million worldwide over the weekend. And the run-up to this was interesting, and I think it's going to inform us about that Robert Downey Jr. and Dr. Doom news, too, because... the lead up to this movie was, this is the worst piece of crap movie I've seen in ages. MCU should be, you know, ashamed of themselves.
I did see some of that, yeah.
And then it kind of, I mean, of course, this is on Twitter too. So right. Twitter's not really the real world, I watched this and I enjoyed it. I like it better than Deadpool 2 for sure. And it's really just an excuse to get the Fox properties in on to the MCU officially and everything. They, you know, the jokey thing about the void in this movie being the 20th Century Fox, the old 20th Century Fox world and everything. Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman have been playing off each other for a long time on Twitter and various things. And it was fun to finally see them actually in a movie. I'm sure they backed up the truck to get Hugh Jackman in this. This is a whole lot of fun. I don't think it's not a total success, obviously. The story is a shambles, I think, in this thing. I don't think that really matters too much, though, in a movie like this, where everything is very cheeky and wink-wink and whatnot. I also didn't think the cameos that were much ballyhooed were that big of a, like, it felt like I was going to run into, like, Ice Capades again, like we did with, you know, No Way Home and all that. But, like, I felt like the cameos here were pretty funny and pretty fun. Although one cameo I thought didn't make sense in this world, and I won't bother to tell you if you haven't seen it, but overall, man, I thought this was a lot of fun. I would say there's a lot of jokes that don't land. There's a lot of jokes that do land. And when you watch this again, you're just going to forget about all the bad ones and then be happy for the good ones. So,
yeah, man, I have a lot of cognitive dissonance about this movie. I called it in my review the most entertaining barely movie I've ever seen.
That's the perfect that's a perfect way to sum it up.
Because it's barely a movie. Like it's it is, but I think you don't have to do anything, but I think you're better off sometimes taking movies on their own terms. And I don't know that this movie is trying to be anything more than a love letter to the Fox Marvel movies and a fun, irreverent, you know, raunchy journey through them. Like, I think that's all this is trying to do. And if so, I think it's succeeding. I mean, there are some killer jokes in this movie, like really great writing of some of the jokes in this movie. And that's fun and that's entertaining. And I say it all the time. I would hang out with Ryan Reynolds in almost any movie he's doing. I just like his vibe. I like his sense of humor. I like his smirky, you know, devilish grin. I like it all. I don't know. It's something that always works for me, whether it's under a mask or not. And it gets a little bit of a chance not to be under a mask in this one, not to spoil anything. It is a hard movie to talk about without spoiling stuff because there's so many fun, revelatory things. But I will say one thing I can talk about without spoiling it is Hugh Jackman was going for Oscars in this movie. Like some of the Hugh Jackman stuff is so good acting-wise in this. I was not prepared for Hugh Jackman just being like, oh, you think I'm going to phone it in? No, I'm going to do some of my best work in Deadpool and Wolverine. Like, there are some scenes where I was just wowed by his performance. So I've always been a Hugh Jackman fan. I'm even more so after this. I think he's so good. But that surprised me.
Without revealing a cameo, although who knows, you might be able to do the detective work on this when I talk about this. There was a funny little throwaway thing in this too when one of the cameos shows up. And there's this whole like meta discussion about who's not here in the void. And they were like, and like this guy didn't make it. And the cameo character had been married to the person who was in that. And they go, it's fine by me.
It works.
You know, and once that's the thing about this, the MCU, it's getting so huge now that they're like, as far as like how many people are in it and everything, like how many different relationships are you going to have to avoid or like talk out or whatever if you ever get a whole like everybody into the same movie at one point, you know, like there's so many like people who dated or married or whatever that are getting into this once MCU and Fox are all together. You got a lot of things to be like, you know, but anyway, yeah. I thought there's a lot of good fun throwaway stuff in this. And overall, I think when I watch it again, there'll be moments I'm like, yeah, that wasn't very good. But for the most part, had a good time with it.
So. I had a blast. I'll just give you my favorite joke. I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, but there are other Deadpool variants in this.
Right.
One of them just looks at the camera at one point and goes, "The proposal." And
yeah. Yes.
And Deadpool goes, "Is that what you think I do?" And it just made me laugh so much.
Yes.
The movie's full of that kind of stuff. And look, it's entertaining. And yes, it's barely a movie, but it's a lot of fun. So I had a good time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The other TV show I wanted to talk about that just finished up is pretty controversial. A lot of people hate this show. I'm on the other side. I love this show. That's Star Wars The Acolyte finished up. And I wanted to talk about season one. I think this is the best Star Wars show this side of Andor. Andor was phenomenal in on its
Andor's
own level.
Andor's awesome.
It really was. But the reason I love this show is twofold. One, this delivers on the promise of the Jedi arts. There are so many really cool, fun battle fight scenes in this, in using the Force in unique, fun ways, shot really well, not quick cut nonsense where you can't tell what's going on. Some really great fight choreography with lightsabers. And that almost alone is enough for me to go, yeah, let's do more of this, because we just haven't had a ton of that recently, and it's really good here. The other reason I love this show is kind of the reason a lot of people hate it. It feels almost, not anti-Star Wars, but in the same way maybe The Last Jedi was, where it's willing to take the idea of the Jedi and deconstruct it a little bit. And not have it be this, because I think when we grew up with the Jedi, we're like flawless and these, you know, always, you know, on the right side of history kind of people. And the more you start to think about them, you realize they're kind of an unfeeling, you know, stuffy religious cult in a lot of ways. And this TV show kind of does a really interesting comparison between Jedi and the modern wrestling we are doing with our own police forcing. You know, the idea of what force is and, you know, what it means to be a policing agency. And it really has some kind of one-to-one comparisons to a lot of stuff that our culture is going through that I found really impacting. And so, yeah, it had me thinking. Had me enjoying it. I really enjoyed Acolyte season one. So, that's about as much as I can say about it. But yeah,
it's been a long. I haven't seen this or anything, but this is another one of those that I don't know what the general public thinks about the show, or whatever. Because I've heard great reviews, like great, and then you get on Twitter, and again, Twitter is a different animal. You get all the toxic people who are like, this is not the way this is supposed to happen and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, hashtag not my Star Wars, you know, kind of thing. Yeah.
Right. And I just keep on wondering, you know, what would Star Wars fans, like if you could get a million hardcore Star Wars fans, give them all the resources in the world, what would they make and would it be good? And I would say probably not, because everybody's got a different sort of opinion about what, and who cares? I mean, everything always has to be perfectly in the canon of all the things that have ever come before it. Like, is that where we're at? Where we're at now? So like, I don't know. I feel like this is probably a good show from what I'm reading between the lines. The people who don't like it have some really weird just, to me, criticisms of it that don't really make sense. And it seemed like every time I would see somebody make one of these weird criticisms that would get, you know, 35,000 likes or whatever like that, somebody would counterpoint it and it would get even more likes. So, like, you know, it was one of those type of things where it's like, I think this is actually probably a good show. I'm just going to have to see for myself someday. So,
yeah, it's not perfect. I think a couple of the performances could be a little bit better. I do think it doesn't. It has actually, honestly, a little bit of Game of Thrones Season 8 problem where it tries to get through too much too quickly. And some of the character movements, character changes in the full season, but specifically the last three or four episodes, kind of come out of nowhere, and that's frustrating. So there are some real story issues, but overall, I was having such a good time and also invested in the themes and message of it that I really, really still recommend it. So yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, I'll have to check that out at some point. All right. On to our big recommend.
So just like you, I like to save money, and that's why when Mint Mobile came over to our little corner of the internet, I started to pay attention. And let me tell you, something interesting happened. I realized that I think I have an unhealthy relationship with my existing provider. I had to do this thing where it's like, should I try something new? No, I've been with this provider for so long. And then I got to looking at my bill and I thought, do I really want to keep spending this much money when it appears that Mint Mobile can do the exact same for $15 a month? And that's when I started to click around and find out. To get started, I did just what you can do. Go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. And then right there is where I saw the 3-month plans that were like $15 a month. And that includes the unlimited plan. All of the plans come with high speed data and unlimited talk and text, and they deliver all that on the nation's largest 5G network, which is great. Even better, you can use your own phone number. And I'm kind of, you know, connected emotionally to my phone number. Another thing I probably should dig into in therapy. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That's mintmobile.com/recotopia. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. There is a $45 upfront payment required that's equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. And additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
And it is 1998's Zero Effect, a movie that apparently came out a couple of days after my birthday. I do not remember that. I did see this in theaters, though, even though it wasn't at my theater. I had to go travel for this one. But this is a movie that I have been talking up for a really long time. I'm glad to finally be able to dissect it today. All right. Our movie starts off with Steve Arlo, played by Ben Stiller, telling Gregory Stark, played by Ryan O'Neill, about the things that make Detective Daryl Zero a legend, while cutting to a bar telling his friend Bill why the things that make him a legend also make him super annoying. Arlo represents Zero, who does not leave the house to meet clients. Arlo tells Stark about the case of the man with the mismatched shoelaces, an important political figure who could not be found, but Zero found him after a phone call from a third party and an hour of desk work. Throughout this opening, Arlo tells us that Zero's strengths as a detective do not translate to great social skills, and he paints the picture of a very Sherlock Holmesian mind who can figure out impossible things just by looking at you. The wealthy Stark finally gets to why he needs Zero. He has lost his keys, and he needs to find them. But don't spend too long laughing at this punchline, because Stark then explains he's being blackmailed, and the key that he's worried about goes to a safety deposit box. We are now introduced to Zero, played by Bill Pullman. He's playing an awful song on guitar, his apartment is a shambles, and he looks like absolute crap. Arlo approaches him in a penthouse apartment guarded by a keypad, a safe door, and another door with 6 padlocks, all with different keys. In addition, Zero has security cameras and an alarm system that still needs a code, even though Zero is already inside. And all the locks need to be locked back and the alarm set after all of this is done. We also get a glimpse of Zero's fridge, which contains a lifetime supply of tab and vodka. Arlo tells him that the case broadly is blackmail, and Zero surprises him by knowing nearly everything about Stark. He is informed another detective, Zero Hates, was assigned to the case and he found nothing. Given that there is so little to go on, Arlo tells Zero he probably needs to go to Portland himself to get new information. It's here we see how much Zero zaps Arlo's time with his selfish ways, because he needs him to take him to the airport tonight and he needs him to come out to Portland in the morning. Arlo has a girlfriend who feels neglected because he's always working. On the way to the airport, Arlo tells Zero about the case. Stark won't tell him what's in the safety deposit box. The keys have been missing for a year. Shortly after the keys went missing, Stark gets his first blackmail letter linking some sort of mystery evidence to a crime. Each payment involves a maze of directions to a drop-off. Each is $100,000, and he's done this 7 times. He's got another drop tomorrow. Stark doesn't want to say anything else about this, which Zero gets frustrated with because he always finds out whatever it is someone wants to hide, and it just wastes time. After all that, Zero tells Arlo that his problems with his girlfriend have nothing to do with him. Cut to Zero writing down his thoughts so that the movie can have narration. He tells us his methods, which he says begin with objectivity and observation, or the two obs, as he calls them. The first thing Zero does is join a gym where Stark is a member and does a lot of observing and listening to get a picture of the person he's working for. Part of this involves trying to book a massage at the same time with the same masseuse as Stark did, only to find out that the masseuse has a regular appointment at that time and maybe he could try the slot that's an hour later. This is where Zero runs into Gloria Sullivan, played by Kim Dickens. Zero is able to discern that she's a paramedic, and despite asking him how he knows that, he gives vague answers about being very intuitive. The counter clerk tells him her name and tells him she's not married for whatever reason. Arlo gets to the Portland airport, where Zero calls him from a payphone inside the same airport, and they have a conversation 2 booths away. Zero tells him that what he observed at the gym while watching Stark, breaking down his character from little things to surmise Stark is deeply paranoid, that he would rather lie to a complete stranger than to tell the truth, that he will drop his Ivy League alma mater with almost no prompting, and he loves his redheaded masseuse. He also tells Arlo that he found an email from a previous detective to Stark telling him that he could find no boxer with the initials of KV. Finally, he tells Arlo that he needs to fly back to LA and get more research right after he just landed in Portland. And meanwhile, break into the previous detective's computer and see if anything is there. When asked why he didn't just call him instead of making him fly all the way out here, Zero tells him he couldn't risk the long-distance lines because they listen. We move on to the scene where Zero follows Stark to his next drop, where there are extra instructions given to Stark on the fly via pager, and involve math problems and specific numbered buses and trolleys. It takes him to a building where he is instructed to go to a men's room, go to the furthest toilet stall from the door, find a plastic bag in the tank, and put the money in there before pulling the fire alarm. Zero somehow gets to the drop before Stark, and without telling the audience how, says that's the way you follow someone. Zero observes the people as the fire alarm goes off, in which no one tells him to get the hell out of there. An ambulance pulls up and Zero notices Gloria Sullivan, the paramedic he met at the gym, go into the men's room and take the cash. Arlo, back in Portland from LA once again, gets a note at a hotel from Zero saying that he's gone back to LA and to wait for him until he gets back in the morning. Zero tells us the importance of great research, and it's here that we see him dive deep into Stark's life, which leads him to a poem Stark wrote called Ode to Clarissa that is awful but becomes a big clue much later on. The next day, Zero follows Gloria, discovering that she visits a facility for seniors and the disabled. Then on to the gym, where Gloria strikes up a conversation with Zero and asks how he knew she was a paramedic, which he explains is because of the smell she gives off from the iodine. As he breaks it down further, even going down to how she must have been in the rain and her hair dried naturally, you get the sense that Gloria already knows that Zero isn't who he appears to be before he even gets a chance to lie about it. He says he's here for business. She guesses accountant because there's a conference in town, and he confirms. She knows his name is Nick Carmine because the counter clerk and matchmaker Daisy told her. Zero finally meets up with Arlo at the hotel in Portland, where Arlo says he found 1,800 names with the initials KV in the area and about 1 million in the whole country. Zero tells Arlo he found the blackmailer, but the way Zero talks about her suggests that he might kinda like her. The next day, Arlo and Stark meet, and it's basically nothing more than a complex way for Stark to give Arlo the money he owes for the investigation. He asks Stark again if there's anything he'd like to add that might help them, but he again refuses. We see Zero searching Stark's office, and he tells us that the best way to find something is to not be looking for anything particular. Because if you're looking for something specific, it's difficult. Because of all the things in the world, you're looking for one of them. But if you're looking for anything at all, it's easy. Because of all the things in the world, you're sure to find some of them. Arlo and Zero meet up, and Zero tells him he found the answer to the KV question, a man by the name of Cregan Vincent. He also found Stark's keys in the couch in the office. The keys and the blackmailer are just a coincidence. The next day at the gym, Gloria asks Zero if he can look at her tax returns. He calls Arlo to see if he can learn enough about tax law to fake it. Zero goes over to Gloria's house and, clearly testing Zero, asks about an obscure tax law that has absolutely nothing to do with her own taxes, which he's able to answer like a true pro, or at least give a good enough answer while faking it. He then actually does her taxes while she takes a nap. When she wakes up, he tells her that she really should keep her receipts for everything. While she takes a shower, Zero snoops around and finds a picture of Craig and Vincent. Over a romantic game of Scrabble, Arlo's girlfriend Jess spells out retired and asks him to retire from his job because he's obviously made a lot of money from it to do so. He says he can't because Zero needs him. Jess puts on the full court press, and Arlo says he'll quit as long as Jess marries him. Gloria and Zero have dinner, furthering the romantic subplot, but she reveals something illuminating. She was raised by her aunt and uncle in L.A. Then they have a romantic target practice where Zero appears to be a bad shot. There's even a premature ejaculation moment when she touches him and he fires the gun out of nervousness. In fact, the whole target practice appears to be a metaphor for committing and leaning in and firing when ready, and Zero hits one of the cans in an amateurish sort of way. But yet again, he lets his guard down in front of Gloria and ends the session by hitting a can, shooting from the hip, giving a look like he still got it. Gloria asks Zero to spend the night at her place, but offers the couch. Zero laments to Arlo that he couldn't tell what Gloria was thinking the whole time, which suggests he's actually become unprofessional when he's with her. Arlo's only new bit of information is that Cregan Vincent is serving a life sentence at a state penitentiary for something the prison records don't explain. He flakes on telling Zero he's going to quit. Arlo goes to a police station to find out that Cregan is in for, and the guy at the records office hands that information over when he says he works for Zero. Cregan's crime is Murder One, and he started serving back in 1972. Zero immediately assumes the victim is named Clarissa, which is correct. The police record further shows that Vincent did a terrible job trying to cover up his crime, leaving fingerprints everywhere. Everyone thinks he's covering for someone, but he won't talk. And then one final bit of interesting information. Vincent was moved from prison to the very senior and disabled facility Zero saw Gloria walk into earlier. He once again goes there to see Gloria pushing Cregan around in a wheelchair. Zero thinks this means that Cregan is her dad and that Gloria is blackmailing Stark because he ruined her father's life. Stark hired Vincent to kill Clarissa for some reason, and she has some sort of evidence that ties him to the murder. They decide to go to the motel where Clarissa was murdered. At this point, Zero goes through a whole list of things that motels could and couldn't do in 1972, so they have to imagine what the room would have been like back then, surmising the bed would have had to have been a queen, and that the wall currently next to the bed covering the pipes of an old radiant water heater. He then tries to recreate what Cregan must have done. He shot her immediately, but then why did he put his hands on everything afterwards? Zero surmises that the bed back in 1972 would not have been allowed to be as close to the wall as it was in the crime photo because it would have been too close to the radiant water heater and against the law. But they can't think of any reason why the bed was moved in the first place. Back at the gym, the nosy counter clerk is talking to Gloria and is happy they've hit it off. She tells her that she could grab onto him because it's tough finding a wealthy single architect from L.A. When Gloria corrects her that he's an accountant, the usually reliable Daisy says she could have swore he said architect. Gloria is once again suspicious of Zero. Arlo goes to talk to Stark by sneaking into his car and scaring the hell out of him, a foreshadowing of Stark's heart troubles. Arlo is interested in the Ode to Clarissa poem, which Stark doesn't even seem to remember. Then Arlo lobs another softball question Stark's way. Why did he kill Clarissa? Stark tells a story of this woman he totally fell head over heels for, but she did not return his feelings. He was obsessed with her, but she didn't want to see him anymore. Then he eventually got married to someone else, and about a year later, he got a letter from Clarissa accusing him of rape. He believed that she just wanted to ruin his life, so he hired Cragen to kill her. Finally, Stark tells Arlo what's in the safety deposit box, a tape that Cragen made when Stark hired him. Why didn't he destroy it? Well, after Cragen goes to jail, he expects Stark to pay for his defense through a middleman. Cragen played a copy of the tape for Stark to hear and threatened Stark that he would turn the tape over to the police if he didn't cave to the demands. Cragen gave him a key, but would only give Stark the location of the deposit box after 25 years or if he died. Arlo tells Zero he wants to quit, and Zero does not take it well. Arlo's main reason for quitting is to have a life with Jess, but he also hates working for the Starks of the world, who are murderers, buying their way out of their problems. This exchange leads to probably my favorite line of the whole movie, where Zero says, "They're the good guys," and Arlo says, "What are you talking about? There aren't any good guys. There aren't evil guys and innocent guys. It's just a bunch of guys." Zero shows his vulnerability by asking Arlo what he's supposed to do without him. If you didn't catch the whole Holmes and Watson connection by now, it's totally in your face. Anyway, after Arlo says he's going to try to find a safety deposit box matching Craig and Vincent, Zero now understands that the prior detective's email talking about there being no boxer named Craig and Vincent probably meant there were no boxes with that name, and it was a typo. Outside the motel, Arlo sees that Stark is pretty resourceful himself, and he's outside waiting. Stark has another blackmail letter. He offers $1 million, nay, $2 million, to sell Zero out and turn over the suspected blackmailer, and then $5 million if Arlo agrees to kill the blackmailer himself. When Arlo turns all that down, Stark threatens to go into the motel room where Zero is, but Arlo threatens to kill him if he tries to go in there. "I have a gun and everything." All of this appears to have been witnessed by Gloria from afar. Zero and Gloria go to dinner and share a milkshake over a 90s soundtrack. He asks about skydiving. He's worried about her doing dangerous things and dying, but she has the philosophy that you can die at any time over any stupid thing, so that's how she gets through it. In true "we need to wrap this movie up" fashion, Gloria tells Zero that she wishes she had red hair like the server, because that's the color hair her mom had. Zero makes a phone call to Arlo, who asks his buddy Bill if a child can be evidence of rape. Bill thinks so if the father doesn't know about the kid. Zero thinks Gloria herself is the evidence that she's been blackmailing Stark with. Gloria is actually Stark's daughter. When Zero returns, Gloria brings the receipts about how he said he never talks to his family, just before he forgets the receipt when they leave the diner. In a moment of vulnerability, it sounds like Zero is telling the truth when he talks about how his father was an evil, abusive man who killed his mother and slit his wrists, a story that is awfully close to Gloria's own. They go home and have sex, Gloria getting on the bed, telling Zero, "Are you gonna just stand there watching, or are you gonna do something about it?" Which is one of the sexiest things I have ever heard in a movie. For the next blackmail drop, the setting is at a planetarium. After dropping off the money, Stark goes inside the planetarium and looks for his blackmailer carrying a gun, but he has a heart attack. Luckily, his unknown daughter is a paramedic and helps him. He seems to think there's a connection, but she stays cold and distant. Zero realizes the safety deposit box would be under the name of Gloria Stark, and he goes to the bank to open it and retrieve the audio tape. He goes to Gloria's and finds her gone, but she calls him expecting him to be there. She's at the airport thinking she needs to escape. What follows is tightening up the remaining loose ends. Cragen killed Clarissa, but noticed that she was hiding a baby behind the bed that was moved too close to the wall. Vincent realizes that he can't let this child be hurt by Stark, so he purposely screws up the whole crime scene, getting rid of the evidence that there was even a baby in there. He then gives Gloria to his sister so that she and her husband can raise her. Gloria grows up believing Cragen is her father before he finally confesses what actually happened, but didn't learn about Stark being her father until a year ago. Zero also has figured out that Gloria knew he was a private detective. The receipt at the diner was one thing that gave him away, among other things. Zero tells her that the man waiting behind her, Arlo, has fake IDs and plane tickets for her to use to lose anyone who might follow her. He gives her a crash course on how to hide her identity. She asks why he didn't come to the airport himself, and he's not sure. He knew she'd be there, but he hoped she'd be at the apartment. She asks him to join her on the adventure, but he can't get away from the PI business. He struggles to say, "I love you," because he's never said it before, but Gloria has one more whammy in store. He doesn't have to say it, because "I love you too, Daryl Zero." At the end, Zero entitles the case The case of the man who got so stressed out over his lost keys that he eventually had a heart attack and they were in the sofa all along. He gives Stark back part of his fee because he didn't tell him everything in the end, but he does give him the keys and the tape. Arlo does indeed retire and marries Jess. Zero attends Kragan's funeral, and he never tried to find Gloria. She was a single, memorable experience. She did for him what he had done for so many, solving a problem with observation and careful intervention. The Zero Effect. The movie coming up with an actual roll credits moment just before the credits. And Aaron, what did you think of this movie?
Had a really good time with Zero Effect. I don't think it's a perfect film, but it is a good watch. And I think the thing I love the most about it is how genuinely smart it is. The dialogue is really, really intelligent. And some of the things that Zero is talking about, you mentioned a couple of them, and I'm going to bring them back up probably as well. Are just really great life lessons and really smart ways to verbalize some things that all of us could learn. The two ops is such a great lesson. The idea of approaching things with objectivity and observation. And boy, couldn't we all use a little bit more of that right now, you know? So I really appreciated that. And then the other one you mentioned as well, which is the idea of when you go looking for something, you're very unlikely to find it. But if you go into something looking for anything, then you're very likely to find something. And it's a really great observation on preconceptions and how preconceptions limit our ability to truly understand the world around us. How we build these preconceived narratives in our own minds about what is the thing that we are looking for, and it keeps blinders on us from seeing the world around us and experiencing new ideas. And I just really think this movie is genuinely smart. I found some interesting things structurally about it. It starts with what feels like could be a typical cold open to a mystery kind of movie like this, where our detective is going to solve a case quickly, and then we're going to move on to the actual case, right? Like that happens a lot of times in detective stories, but it's not that. We jump right into the main case of the movie, and you know the person that we're hearing Ben Stiller's character talk to and kind of give the credentials of Zero to is the person who we're going to solve a case for. So I found that structurally interesting. And I'm not actually sure if I like it better or not. There is something where it's almost better to see the detective give their own bona fides by doing something as opposed to just hearing Watson in this case say, here's why he's so great. He can do this. Well, I'd almost rather see it, you know, like show, don't tell in some ways. But I did find it refreshing in that it just doesn't follow the same old structure that kind of a lot of these stories do. Let's see, what else? Love the Sherlock Watson stuff. Love the Ben Stiller, Bill Pullman stuff. I think the movie could have used even more of it. And I think it is for whatever reason, and I maybe it's just a me thing, the Sherlock Watson stuff is the most interesting stuff about how those mysteries are solved to me, because there's this beautiful interaction between the quirky, not quite in touch with reality brain that sees everything and is able to figure stuff out in the grounded, let me keep you in check. Let me, lead you to the real world in some case. Like that relationship is very interesting to me. And I think there's a reason that we see it with a lot of detectives, not all of them. I don't think Poirot really has a Watson. I don't think, the Knives Out, Daniel Craig character, Blanc. I don't think he really has a Watson. But I do like that kind of relationship, and they're definitely setting that up here, and I enjoyed it. I also felt like, and even did a little bit of research on this, this feels to me like it could have been a TV show. Like, I'm just like, this would be been a really fun television show, and it turns out that they did attempt it. And what's wild to me is Alan Cumming, by the way, would have played Daryl Zero, which I think is very interesting.
Would have been great.
I agree, but this is 2002. You know what else started in 2002? Monk. So in Monk is real. In fact, if Monk weren't a TV show, it might have been my super secret double feature. Like it, there's a lot of interesting like Monk elements to what's going on here. But so it's just it's wild to me that we kind of got the Daryl Zero show in a little bit, but it was something totally different. It was Tony Shalhoub as a character called Monk, but kind of has the same feel to it. Because I just think it's a really interesting idea in that way. I was a little bit not put off, but just like come on through the romance stuff. And I think there's almost a disconnect that the movie is trying to do, like trying to figure out if it's about the case or if it's actually a romance. Is this movie a romance? Yeah. If it's meant to be a romance, then I think maybe you shift some of the character development at the beginning to be more about his loneliness or those kind of things. And if it's meant to be, you know, just a straight mystery, then I don't know why it turns into Body Heat for 5 minutes. You know what I mean? Like it's just a weird kind of tug and pull that I felt during the movie.
Yeah, there is a typical when a movie decides to go into that territory, there's a danger to the detective when they do that. Like there's something that could happen to them or the case if they're found out, but that's never really an issue here at all. I think they're basically just trying to say, "Hey, this is what happens when someone so professional falls in love with the person, and we'll just explore it as the romantic angle and not really you're right, that's one thing they could have fleshed out a little bit more or cut from the movie possibly, although if he's not as intimate as he is with her, he doesn't find out certain things in the mystery. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree with you. That's where the movie does kind of slow down, is in those moments.
It does. It really it just felt like it really thought it was a different movie during that sex scene, especially. Like it was just like it spent a lot of time on the sensuality of it, and the rest of the movie feels the tone feels a little different than that. To me. But then you look at like how it ends, and I think you mentioned this, how he talks about at the end in his notes about how she used the Zero effect to, you know, help him with something that he hadn't understood about himself or whatever. And again, I think if that's the movie, if the movie is the romance and how his journey is impacted by that romance, I just think it needs to be restructured a little bit so that the case doesn't feel like the main thing. But maybe that's me just kind of nitpicking at it a little bit. I think the actual case really works, and I love that. I love when a detective story has a case where I'm like, that's an interesting case. It's an interesting way you solved it. I love that kind of Sherlock stuff. Very, very cool.
Yeah.
I love some of the lines. I think specifically of it's a W-2. WW2 is World War II. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Just made me laugh. Yes. I was entertained. I had a good time. Had some issues with structure and kind of inconsistency, but yeah, it's a really fun movie.
Yeah. And this movie this is one of these movies that I've probably seen more than 20 times. Mm-hmm. Cause I had the DVD and I'd lost the DVD and I had to buy the DVD again. But I used to watch this all the time. And this is, I don't know if I've ever seen a better Bill Pullman performance than this. Maybe somebody out there has a better one. I mean, you know, a lot of people are going to refer back to his Independence Day speech and stuff that he does in Independence Day is possibly his best. But this one, he does so many things in it that I just love in it. The way he describes that that his father was an evil, abusive man, and this is probably the first time he's ever said this out loud to somebody. And it just kind of like escaping from his mouth and just letting it just kind of go out, and you can see how ashamed he is of it, and how much he doesn't want to talk about it. He does so many little things that I've never seen Bill Pullman do in any other real, in any other movie that I've seen him in, really. Ben Stiller at this time, this is before There's Something About Mary hits, and he's been doing a lot of like indie movies at this point. I think Permanent Midnight came out around this time too. And he's kind of working his way as this, you know, up and coming actor, and There's Something About Mary is what just blows the lid off of his career, and he goes on to a long run there. I love him in this, although there's some moments where I think Ben Stiller's a little bit off in this, but like, he's got great lines. I've already mentioned a couple of them. I love all of his interactions with Stark, because his contempt of Stark gets worse and worse and worse as the movie goes on. You know, this is one of these guys who just buy off everything, and he hates that about him, and you can see that seething. And the moment where he sneaks into his car and he immediately goes into that Ode to Clarissa thing, and he's like, all right, how do you pronounce the TOWARDS? How do you pronounce that? And he's like, towards? And he's like, yeah, and those things that fly in the sky, what are they called? And he's like, birds? And he's like, yeah, it doesn't rhyme. And you can tell Stark has no idea. He has completely forgotten about this poem that he's written that's somehow on the internet somewhere. And I just love that about him. And throughout this thing, it just gets angrier and angrier. And just, you know, finally he's like, if you go in there, I'm going to shoot you. I've got a gun and everything. Yes, and the mystery for me has always been the draw for this movie.
Yeah.
The details that they, you know, this is a classically constructed mystery. I love how they find these little details. They don't know what they are, and they don't really make assumptions about them until they find more information and everything. So I've always been a big fan of the mystery in this one, so that's a good thing. But yeah, this has been one of those movies. This is one of these movies that I've wanted people to see for a really long time, and I'm glad some of you guys got to see it, perhaps for the first time here. And I hope that you enjoyed it. Once you hype something up so much, there's going to be some letdown, I'm sure. But I'm glad that we got to finally see it. A couple of other things. Jake Kasdan has had quite the career,
right?
You know, after this, he's still doing kind of indie movies. He did Orange County before this, and then he did the TV set, and then he has a semi hit with Walk Hard. Although Walk Hard wasn't like a big,
and he wrote that really too.
Yeah, exactly. But his biggest stuff is Jumanji.
I know.
He's done two Jumanji movies, and so like those things. He's probably set for life on that. But the other thing is, I thought was fun. This is one of those things. Was it's good to be a Nepo baby. You know, he's the son of Lawrence Kasdan, who was making The Accidental Tourist in 1987, and that's how Jake Kasdan met Bill Pullman, and then 11 years later, they're making a movie. I thought that was an interesting little connection.
Very cool.
All right, let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I thought about Knives Out for this, in other murder mysteries that might, you know, kind of fit in here. And of course, I mentioned I thought Monk. I even for a second considered using the Monk movie that just recently came out, because there is a Monk movie and I actually kind of enjoyed it. In the end, I decided to find a mystery that was similar but still a kind of a detective kind of thing that really emphasized the partnership and friendship angle more the way that I wanted it to. And so for my double feature, I went with The Nice Guys. That felt like a nice spiritual kind of connection to the Stiller-Pullman relationship. I think that way. So yeah. So my double feature is The Nice Guys.
Man, talk about a great evening at the movies.
Yeah.
You watch Zero Effect and then The Nice Guys right after that.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. All right. On to what is going to be our homework for next week. It's Aaron's turn. What do you think?
I will mention, I think 2 weeks. I think we're
oh, that's right.
off next week. So this will be for 2 weeks. And the homework is going to be Hail Caesar.
Oh, there you go. This is a polarizing movie.
It is, and it's one of my favorites. And so I am excited for the opportunity to take a look at it and to introduce some to it, whether they love it or hate it, because I'm definitely on the love it side and excited to talk about it either way.
I like it. I don't know if I've ever gotten to love on this one, and I'm glad that we'll be able to do a deep dive on this one. But yeah, this feels like the Coen Brothers movie that didn't get the cult following.
Yeah,
like Big Lebowski wasn't a hit, got a huge cult following. Burn After Reading, not a huge movie, got a huge cult following. But I don't think Hail Caesar has ever gotten to that level yet. Maybe it has, and I just haven't been paying attention. But this is going to be good. So yes, if you didn't hear that, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Not next week. I had completely forgotten that. But yes, we'll be back in 2 weeks to be talking about Hail Caesar. So you have a couple of weeks to watch this movie. I think we have time for one question.
That's good.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Who is an actor in a film that is so well disguised you almost didn't realize it was them?
This is one that I had an immediate response in my brain because it's recent, and you could take the word almost out. I did not realize it was them until afterwards. And part of this is I go into movies as blind as possible. Don't watch trailers. Don't do a lot of studying on, you know, who's in it, those kind of things beforehand. I did not realize until afterwards that was Colin Farrell in the Batman. The makeup performance and the acting performance are so different than anything I've ever seen him do that it just kind of blew my mind. I was like, who is that playing the Penguin? And then in the credits, it was like Colin Farrell. And I was like, that is not true. That cannot be true, but it was true. So that was my immediate answer.
Mine is one of Tilda Swinton's characters in Suspiria, the Luca Guadagnino Suspiria, where she's playing an old man, and I had no idea it was her. I knew she's playing multiple parts in that movie, but when her character as the old man came up, I was like, who is this? This is somebody in makeup, but I don't know who it is. And then slowly dawned on me through the rest of the movie. Oh, that's Tilda Swinton. Tilda Swinton is that character. I thought that was that was kind of crazy. Going over to chat, it says here, Slab says Gary Oldman in everything. Yeah, he does kind of chameleon a lot, especially in stuff like True Romance and things like that. Nolan says Tom Cruise in Tropic Thunder, which is a big one. That's a really, really good one. Like, I don't think a lot of people knew that was Tom Cruise until the credits rolled at the end. Tatsu Kagamaru, I don't know how to pronounce that. I'm sorry. Carl Urban in Judge Dredd. And then another vote there from Nolan for Colin Farrell in The Batman. Flyboy says Albert Finney in the 1970s Murder on the Orient Express. Absolutely. He looks completely different in that movie. And Nick says Gary Oldman in Leon or The Professional for some of you. Yeah, for sure. A lot of great answers there.
Back and just give props to Slab for this answer. Gary Oldman in everything, I think, is the way it is.
That's true. And sorry, Tatsu, it looks like you're mad. I'm sorry. I don't mean to not know your name, but it's one of those things where there's like a million million mm-hmm. letters that I have to parse into the thing, and like which one's the words and which ones aren't. Sorry.
Yep.
I'm sorry. One day maybe you'll write it out for me and I can pronounce it better. All right, that's going to do it for this week. Next week, 2 weeks from now, it'll be Hail Caesar. So that's going to do it for today. So we'll see you next time.
See you guys. See ya.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Man, I am addicted to the Olympics.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I think it has to do with how good their online, like the apps that, like Peacock. Like, they've just got it all figured out now. Like, you go to mm-hmm. Peacock and you can just watch, like, it'll tell you what all sports are live. You can pick, you know, replays to watch, whatever. Mm. And then it also does a really good job of, like, organizing the coverage. So, like, there are live streams of what's called the Gold Zone, which is on most of the day, where they will jump around while stuff is live, because I think it's like, you know, 6-7 hours, you know, later there or whatever. So stuff's been going on. Mm-hmm. And then that happens through the day. And then they'll do, you know, Olympics in prime time stream, which I think is on NBC affiliates as well, obviously, but it's also there on Peacock, where it'll give you the highlights and stuff. And so, like, you can kind of pick your own adventure as to what you're watching and interested in. And I've always loved the Olympics. And so it's really interesting to have kind of everything at your fingertips. Just like, hey, I want to watch some archery right now. All right, let's do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I, in the past, I've watched a lot of Olympics. This year, I have not. And I don't know what that is. I do enjoy watching it. It's just haven't gotten the bug this year. But from what you're telling me, it's way better than what it was in like past years. I think NBC started a thing long time ago, like in the 90s, and they called it the Olympics Triple Cast. And I don't remember if it was if that was the first time that was like a multi-channel thing, mm-hmm. or if they had three things going on at once on the screen. I don't remember what the triple cast was all about, but that was the first sort of attempt at that. And then over the years, they started doing that thing that they do that CBS does with the Final Four, where they stick games on, you know, channels you have not watched the entire year, like,
right?
You know, True TV mm-hmm. and things like that. You've got to find them. And so the Olympics were the same way. Anything that was NBC Universal, you could go and find something. But the issue too with that is, especially with you know, the time difference and everything, you didn't know what was live, and you didn't know what was, you know, they didn't tell you any of that stuff. So it sounds like here that you've got a full range thing that tells you this is live, this is not a recording, this is
right.
You know, this is something that you don't have to, you know, it's something you had to navigate back in the day. Now it looks like they got it kind of under a good system.
Yeah, and there is one channel you can watch that has like the four main sports that are being covered live right now, and mm. you can move your cursor, and whichever one you're on, you'll hear the sound from, which is nice. And then if you just click the button, it'll, you know, bring that one full screen. It's just like they've really got it figured out. And like if you're watching, let's say, Gold Zone or the primetime coverage, and let's mm-hmm. say they're doing a piece on the men's basketball game or whatever that happened, something will pop up in the corner and it'll say, you know, men's basketball Sunday at, you know, 3 p.m. add to my stuff. And you just click the button and then it, you know, will record that for you or have that available for you. Like they've really gotten smart about it. So it makes it really easy to watch the stuff you care about and, you know, kind of follow along. And it's, yeah, I've really been enjoying watching it. I think the two main reasons I love the Olympics are both probably very naive on my part, but like there's something about the world competing together in a non-violent way. You know what I mean? Where it's just like coming together, show our stuff. You know, here's our athletes from our country. Let's compete. There's a unity to it that's really attractive to me, especially when you think of, you know, the all the conflicts going on in the world, and specifically the two major conflicts that we're very aware of with, you know, Israel and Hamas and, you know, Ukraine and Russia. Like, you just think of that stuff being so tragic and so traumatic and so terrible. And then here's this other example of everybody getting, you know, together on the same page and doing something really spectacular, you know, the biggest feats in sports. And that's the other reason I like it. Just watching the best people at all the stuff, you know, I'm always attracted to watching people who have dedicated their lives to becoming the best at something. And this is just like a buffet of that, you know? Yeah. So it's I don't know. It's a lot of fun for me.
Well, and it was always funny to me too, that we all gather to watch these sports during the Olympics because we put assigned some sort of importance to the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
Like these people compete all year,
all the time,
they're setting records and they're you know, all sorts of stuff outside of the Olympics. That's why they do that thing where it's like, this is the Olympic record, this is the world record, but like. But like, I always feel bad about it because it's like, yeah, all year this guy has been tearing it up, and like, I'm like, oh, I just now heard of this person, and I'm watching you at the Olympics, man. I'm here.
Yeah,
you know,
it's the men's gymnastics has been a fun story over the last couple of days, and it's so interesting how quickly you can attach yourself to something just because you're from the same country, right? So you're watching the Olympics and like, why am I falling in love with these men? Just because they have the stars and stripes on and they're competing for our country. But like, you know, you go through the pain with them. Like, their best gymnast had a terrible qualifying rounds. Like, he didn't qualify for any of the individuals. He, you know, basically made it so the U.S. barely qualified for the men's final, team final. He just, you know, he fell on the high bar a couple times and fell off the pommel horse and just had a really bad day. And you just think, like, it doesn't define him as a person, but this is the time when most of the eyeballs are on him. So how do you come back from that? Like, how do you go to bed that night and then come back the 2 days later, I think, or no, maybe it was the next day, and do the men's all around because they did qualify. Now you've got all that still on your shoulders for your team, and the goal, you know, and the medal is at stake now. And he did. He somehow managed to put that all behind him and have great routines on all the stuff for the medal rounds. So, like,
I have no idea. You know, I mean, it feels like you'd always be thinking about these failures that you had and everything, but I guess, you know, that's what makes certain athletes so amazing, is that they can put that out of their head. Although that turned into an ugly thing a few years ago with Simone Biles, because people were talking about how, wow, she can't get that out of her head, what a weak person that is. And it's like, I mean, not everybody's built to just take things out of their head like that. It doesn't matter how world class they are and everything. Like, why do we always assume, you know, these people are got the iron will every single time? So
yeah, I heard her talk about, because that's been a big story too. She's back. She's leading the women's team this year, and you know, they talked to her about it, and she said, "You train so hard for the physical aspect of what you're doing, and you don't train as hard for the mental aspect. Like, you know, that is part of your training. The mental part is part of it." But it's not quite the same, right? And she had, she said she had to take a lot of time to get, you know, her head in a space where she understood that part of herself, you know? And so she's done a lot of work in the last 3 years, because I think last time, because of COVID, it was 21, to really, you know, understand herself and be able to compete and also be so strong mentally to understand, you know, what it is, what it isn't, what's valuable about it, how it defines you, how it doesn't define you, all those kind of things. So, and she's performing really well and seems to, you know, be going through it fine this time. So yeah, I find it all so fascinating. There's one guy on the men's Olympic team, his whole thing is pommel horse, right? So there's five guys on the team. They do the team final. He doesn't compete in anything until Pommel Horse. And Pommel Horse was their last event in the medal rounds, and he competes last in the event. So he's the very last guy going to seal or lose their medal, you know, chances or whatever. And it's the only thing he's done all day. He's just sat there all day going over his Pommel Horse routine in his mind. And
that's crazy.
Yeah, it was another one of the fun stories from yesterday, actually. That was, but man, yeah, I'm just having a good time. I love sports. I love competition. It's just it's fun to watch people be amazing at stuff.
I wonder how many, you know, I wonder if Simone Biles went to a sports psychologist, because I've heard many stories of baseball players doing this. I think Steve Sachs, back in the day, he had a case of the yips where he couldn't throw the ball to first base, which is really bad when you're a second baseman. And I think he went to a sports psychologist and he got it ironed out. But some people never get it ironed out. But like, yeah, I'm wondering what it is in the sports psychology world that gets your head space in the right, you know, is it as easy as like in Ten Cup where he's shanking all the time and then like Cheech Marin does all this stuff to make him look ridiculous, and then he suddenly can drive the ball without shanking it anymore? Is it just as easy as like, just don't think about it? Just, you know, it's not as important as you think it is or whatever? Or is it just a series of like complex, you know, I don't know, man. It's like kind of, it's fascinating to me how they get over it or whatever.
Yeah, in gymnastics, I guess they call it the twisties. That's what Simone called it. You get the twisties, and all of a sudden your body doesn't know which way to twist, and or something like that. And she literally recounted that, you know, crazy vault she did 3 years ago where she didn't do any of the things she was supposed to do. She just basically just, you know, did a flip or something, and she was like, I just couldn't remember. My brain couldn't comprehend what I was supposed to do. And what a terrifying place to be in as a gymnast when you're throwing your body 15 feet into the air.
This isn't nearly, I want to make this clear. This isn't nearly Olympic sport type of thing, but I feel like it's related in some way as far as, you know, just mental aspect of thing. I played this game Hollow Knight over the past year or so. And there's a section of that game where there's these little levers that go up and down, up and down, up and down, and at all varying speeds. And you have to hit things just right to get through that thing. It's basically the Galaxy Quest thing, essentially, that they have to go through. There would be moments I would go, okay, I know how to do this. I've got this time down. And you go through, and then you'd make a slight mistake, and you'd get hit, and you'd have to go all the way back to this one part and then go come back and whatever. And you'd do that after a while, and then finally you're like, all right, I'm going to do this, man. I'm going to get this. I'm definitely going to get this. And then I would freeze. I would just sit there and go, well, I think I've got this time down, but and you just sit there and just – I just sat there and could not move. Because I was just I don't want to screw this up. And I can only imagine what that's like when you're twisting and contorting your body and like putting yourself in danger, and it's very complex. And oh my God.
Yeah. I can't imagine the terror of something like that. It's wild. I was talking with my brother actually about how world records keep getting broken. You know, like we just keep getting faster. And it's like, sure, maybe some of it's technology, like, you know, swifter swimsuits or a better understanding of water dynamics. Like there's some science to it, whatever. We understand our bodies better, oxygenation of the blood and the muscles and all these kind of things. But we're also just getting better at stuff all the time as human beings. Mm-hmm. And that's just... You know, you think of like evolution, like thousands of years or tens of thousands of years or whatever. You can, you know, kind of conceptualize that a little bit better. But like 4 years later, all of a sudden we can swim a minute faster in the 1600. Like that's just
right.
It's just wild to think how we keep pushing ourselves to these limits.
Is it really just people are better at it, or is it that they're learning like certain motions that make things faster? Like,
it's got to be both, but like, right. Yeah, there was a time where the 4 minute mile was looked at as impossible. And right. Now recreational runners run 4 minute miles. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's
right.
It's just, it's weird.